Ladies and gentlemen, Theosophical Society has much pleasure in presenting Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson, international lecturer and author, in the first talk in a series on the hidden wisdom in the Christian scriptures.
Ladies and gentlemen, the necessity for a study of our Bible in search of a deeper wisdom concealed behind the literal reading is now being generally recognized. It is now admitted, even by eminent Christian divines, that many problems arise from such a literal reading of the text of the Bible. In October 1962, for example, a statement was made by the Reverend Dr. Leslie Weatherhead, a former president of the Methodist Conference and minister at the famous City Temple, London. This statement appeared in the press, and in the course of it, the Reverend Doctor, who, by the by, is also the author of a booklet entitled The Case for Reincarnation, said, in effect, that he would like to go through the Bible, being very free with a blue pencil. He was rather frank, I thought, going on to say that he would like to cut out a lot of massacres and stories about children being crushed against walls. Still more recently, a book called Honest to God has been written by the Bishop of Woolwich, Dr. John Robinson. In it, the bishop makes it clear that he personally, although a bishop, does not believe in God as a separate being, and furthermore, that he is agnostic about such matters as the virgin birth. The existence of such views, and the publicity given to them at this time, indicate, I suggest, an urgent need. Not necessarily for an expurgated edition of the Bible, but rather for an interpretation of its more abstruse and difficult passages. For studied as allegories, certain of even the more undesirable portions of the Bible can prove to be revelations of a priceless treasure of knowledge, a wisdom deliberately concealed beneath the veil of allegory, parable, and symbol. The subject of the sacred language, as it is called, in which the scriptures and mythologies of ancient people are said to have been written, is a vast one, and I cannot pretend to be able to do full justice to it, even in a series of lectures. Fortunately, books are appearing on the subject. One I recommend to you all who are interested. It is called A Dictionary of the Sacred Language of All Scriptures and Myths, and is written by G. A. Gaskell. Some of the interpretations which I shall offer, but not all of them, are drawn from a reading of this valuable work. My hope in giving this present series and in writing books upon the subject has been at least fourfold. First, as indicated by the title of this series, I hope to draw attention to the presence of a profound wisdom to be discerned in many of the books of the Bible. Secondly, I hope to provide solutions of extremely difficult passages. I've selected some of them and will offer interpretations. Thirdly, I want to offer ideas by the use of which criticisms of Christianity may be answered, and we who love the faith in which we have been brought up can answer those criticisms. Fourthly, I seek to introduce certain of the teachings of the ageless wisdom which is known today as theosophy. Here then, let us look at them together, are some general principles. The Holy Bible, as also the scriptures of other faiths, has from remote times been regarded by certain scholars as being largely, but not entirely, allegorical. It is said to be constructed partly of history, of historicized metaphors, allegories, and symbols. Why was this method of writing used? Well, for several purposes, I think. Here are some of them. To convey abstract ideas in concrete forms, thereby making them understandable by the ordinary human mind. Another purpose, to describe phases of human evolution and associated metaphysical experiences. Also, to evoke wonder and so initiate inquiry. To preserve for posterity profound spiritual and therefore power-bestowing truths. Please remember that. Truth is power-bestowing, and when it's grasped and realized, it does indeed endow its possessors with a certain remarkable power. So, I have said, one of the purposes for the sacred language is to preserve for posterity profound spiritual and therefore power-bestowing truths. And last in my list, to conceal from the profane knowledge which could be misused, even whilst also and at the same time revealing this knowledge to the selfless servant of humanity. This is so important that I'm just going briefly to repeat those purposes. One, to convey abstract ideas in concrete and therefore understandable forms. To describe phases of human evolution, especially the more advanced ones, and associated metaphysical experiences. To evoke wonder and so initiate inquiry. Most valuable, that one also. To preserve for posterity profound spiritual and therefore power-bestowing truths. And to conceal from the profane knowledge which could be misused, whilst at the same time revealing it to the selfless servant of humanity. We do not have to look far, do we, to realize the necessity for this reservation of knowledge. It becomes clear, doesn't it, when the destructive use to which modern man puts scientific discoveries is observed. One example, an obvious one, of course, is the misuse of knowledge as an explosive and atomic bombs. The power or energy derived from nuclear fission and fusion will eventually be used for peaceful purposes, but its first use, you remember, was as an explosive agent in the atomic bomb. Recognizing that their discoveries belong to the race, the philosophers and scientists of former days knew that spiritual and occult knowledge, if made generally available, and, yes, and particularly if placed in the hands of disruptive elements in society, could, like atomic energy, be extremely dangerous. So they constructed the cryptic language called the sacred language. In this, the inspired scriptures and mythologies of the world are said to have been written. These scriptures, although founded in general upon historical records, even at times including the writings of ignorant men of the time, nevertheless certain of the narratives are so related as to possess under-meanings, which reveal not historical but eternal, timeless truths. Whilst apparently historical, many biblical stories are also metaphorical, having an inner purport, which, when discovered, reveals layer upon layer of hidden wisdom. Do you begin to see now how very important this approach, both to the scriptures and mythologies of ancient people, but also to knowledge itself, can be? I hope so. Many great teachers used this method. Our Lord Christ himself, when addressing his disciples, talked directly to them of spiritual truths, as, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount. But to non-disciples he spoke in parables, as he said. Here are his words on the subject. "Give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet, and turn again and rend you." Matthew 7:6. Our Lord also said to his disciples privately, "Unto you it is given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God, but to them that are without, all these things are done in parables." Mark 4:2. One reason for this differentiation I have already suggested. Knowledge can indeed bestow power, and one might say perhaps that the writers of the sacred language were in olden days somewhat in the same position in which a small group of modern scientists would find themselves after having first discovered atomic energy and then methods for its controlled release. The ancient teachers would not dare immediately to make their discovery universally available. The just men made perfect, as St. Paul calls them, Hebrews 12:23, the wise men of old, having investigated the whole nature of man and the complete structure of matter as they veritably did, and also having discovered the forces locked up within man and matter, they just the same. They similarly felt a heavy sense of responsibility. They had to prevent the misuse of their knowledge and to ensure its preservation for the future benefit of mankind. Remember, of course, that even atomic energy can only injure physical bodies of human beings and others and break up physical forms, but occult and spiritual knowledge, if perverted and misused for unholy purposes, can warp the very soul of those who become their victims and delay and turn aside for a time the evolution of the inner self through the soul and body thus injured. And so, to prevent this happening, the ancient seers devised, not the algebraical symbols and formulae of the modern scientist, but a cryptic language in which some of the words retain their normal meaning, whilst others are cryptograms or hierograms, meaning holy words, for spiritual and occult truths. In doing this, the writers of old knew that only those who possessed the keys of interpretation would be able to discover the truths which the sacred language both reveals and, at the same time, very skillfully conceals. Of course, the secret is rendered still safer by the fact that in order to know and use the keys with full success, one must also have developed the intuitive faculty to a sufficient degree, and also be imbued with a reasonably strong sense of moral responsibility. For these imply the attainment of a certain measure of the evolution of the mind and the higher understanding. Only then can the secrets be discovered. Human nature is what it is, however, and the possession of power can even then evoke a lust for its misuse for personal ends. Hence the whole system of the sacred language of allegory and symbol. Such, then, briefly but partially described, it's a very big subject, friends, are the origin and the main purposes of the sacred language, in which, as I've just said, the scriptures and mythologies of ancient peoples are said to have been written. Now let us go on and look into the matter more fully and take some passages of the Bible and apply this theory to them. We shall find it very useful, I think, for in addition to its value as a key to the wisdom concealed in world scriptures, knowledge of the sacred language can also contribute to the solution of certain otherwise quite insoluble biblical problems. This can be very helpful, especially to those whose religious life is largely founded upon sacred books. For, you know, whilst belief or faith in the possibility of supernatural intervention may make some scriptural statements credible, neither fundamental physical laws nor astronomical facts can ever be changed. Nevertheless, as you may know, in the first chapter of the book of Genesis, it is implied that 3 days and 3 nights had passed before the sun, the moon, and the stars were created, as in verse 16. That really cannot literally be true, can it? Records of certain miracles also strain almost beyond reasonable limits one's power to believe in them. Think, for example, of the hydrostatic pressure exerted in dividing and holding back on either side in great walls the waters of the Red Sea, leaving a dry bed over which the Israelites crossed on the exodus from Egypt. Think also of the same thing when the river Jordan was similarly divided by Joshua, as in the book of Joshua, chapter 3, verses 14 to 17. These actions must have involved the use of almost incalculable energy, if possible at all. If, however, as indicated in the biblical text, direct divine theurgic action is presumed to have occurred in these two last cases, then such miracles might not have been wholly impossible. A complete astronomical impossibility is, however, presented as an accomplished fact when Joshua is said to have made the sun and moon stand still in order to prolong the day. Joshua 10, verses 12 to 14. Now, friends, the heliocentric system cannot by any means be altered. The sun is in fact established at the center of the solar system for which it is the source of light. Planets revolve on their axes throughout their orbital motion round the sun. Without this rotation of planets on their axes, the alternations of day and night would not occur. Furthermore, the speed of the rotation of the Earth decides the duration of night and day, and not in the very least the motion of the sun. The prolongation of either day or night by the sudden arrest or great slowing up of the motion of either sun or earth is a total impossibility. The moon, of course, would not be directly concerned in such a procedure. But if the earth had suddenly stopped, ceased from turning, no human being would have lived to record the event. Every movable object on earth, including the oceans and also the atmosphere, and even Joshua himself, would have continued the normal rotating movement and thus traveled towards the east faster than the speed of sound. So you see, thus examined with ordinary intelligence, it is virtually impossible either to accept the story literally oneself or to defend our beloved Bible against harsh, destructive criticism. What shall we do then? Well, if the accepted keys of interpretation be applied to the story, it is then possible to discern in it a description of certain powers susceptible of harmful misuse, hence the symbolical veil, certain powers attained by illumined men and women. In the human rather than the universal interpretation, allegories are always susceptible of both, don't forget. In the human interpretation, the sun, for example, is customarily used as a symbol of the highest spirit in man, whilst the moon represents his mortal nature. Day is a commonly used word in allegories. It is regarded and used as descriptive of a mental condition of illumination, whilst battles such as Armageddon and Kurukshetra and this battle of the Israelites against Gibeon, these can be interpreted as allegories of the interior conflict between man's spiritual self and his sensual and other undesirable propensities, these latter being frequently personified as enemies. So you see, the great scriptural battles are within man, are waged within man, and he himself is the battlefield where spirit and all the higher propensities wage war, so to say, against the animal in man. Now the sun represents the power of assured victory, especially when it is at its meridian, or as the Bible says, in the midst of the heavens. This means that the sun, as also the spiritual will in the allegory, are at the position of maximum power. This indicates both the achievement of a state of full illumination of the mind, day, and the attainment of complete dominance of the outer form by the inner spirit. When the inner will is thus established in complete command, the sun at its meridian, the mortal man is conquered or ruled by the immortal self, whilst the mind at the same time becomes fully illumined by spiritual light, or it is day. The exalted initiate, Joshua in this case, attains thus a state symbolized by daylight, daytime, day, and as a result achieves victory over the enemy. Now you see, friends, that if such a deeply psychological reading be accepted, then the astronomical error need no longer turn one away from a scriptural source, especially if one is really seeking wisdom. On the contrary, the apparent absurdity of the letter may serve as a clue to the power-bestowing wisdom contained in the spirit of the passage. But this wisdom is deliberately hidden, so the student is taught. This wisdom is deliberately hidden beneath a veil of allegory and symbol. Almost irresistible power is indeed involved in the revelation, for when once a man has discovered his true spiritual self and its unity with God, then the powers of the cosmos are at his disposal. And still being human, of course, he can either use them or misuse them. Hence the reservation. Such a revelation is, however, based upon abstract ideas, descriptions of intangible forces, knowledge of laws and truths, and to bring these within the reach of the formal mind, they are personified as gods, goddesses, angels, people, heroes, patriarchs, prophets. And the whole story is cast into a wonderful allegory and myth. These are said to be the source of the scriptural narratives of our Bible.
This segment of the program has now concluded. The next segment will begin momentarily.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Theosophical Society has much pleasure in presenting Mr. Geoffrey Hodson, international lecturer and author, in the second talk in his series on the hidden wisdom in the Christian Scriptures.
Friends, in this second talk, I am going to apply some of the ideas which I presented in the first talk to the well-known and well-loved story from the childhood of many of us of Noah and his ark. What can this strange and in many ways quite impossible story really mean? Let's look at it together. If the view be accepted that the scriptures are partly composed of allegory and symbol, then the biblical account of the planetary flood may also be read as descriptive of the engulfing of universes and their several components within the so-called waters of space at the end of epochs of creative activity, major and minor. Such an approach leads one, admittedly, towards the more esoteric aspects of the ageless wisdom. But I am not hesitating to offer these to you, knowing the interest which exists in them. For example, Noah, he himself, may be regarded as a personification in the cosmic interpretation of one of the seven mighty spirits before the throne, together with the associated hierarchy of archangelic and angelic hosts. The head of this order, of this hierarchy, has, for example, as one of his tasks, to gather up and sublimate into the highest spiritual essence and to preserve them during periods of quiescence all the fruits of the major period of manifestation. The essential power, life, consciousness, and monads, that's the divine sparks or innermost spiritual selves of a universe of whatever dimensions, symbolized by the presence of the pairs of all animals and by the family of Noah, all these are preserved within the aura or superphysical vehicles, symbolized always by the ark, by the by, the superphysical vehicles of this representative of the appropriate order of the Elohim, angelic hosts, symbolized by Noah. This process of the preservation of the seeds of living things within the aura of an exalted member of the inner government of the solar system throughout periods of quiescence or nights, this process is universal. It's repeated at all levels, as also for a whole solar system. The ancient wisdom theosophy itself teaches that in the case of planetary epochs of varying dimensions, known as chains, rounds, and single globes, a preserving official known as a Manu may be a member of the human kingdom of nature who has attained to a lofty superhuman stature. The innermost spiritual selves of men, with their potentialities and their developed powers and faculties, are preserved in a sublimated state during the period of rest within the aura of this great official, the Manu, as he's called in occult and Hindu literature, and personified very wonderfully and accurately by Noah himself. For in this period between manifestations, these periods of rest, all the forms which have existed disintegrate, and their substance, losing its individualized vibratory frequencies, returns to the pre-creative state. And this formlessness is symbolized by the waters of the flood. Then rest or night ended, whether the head of the great hierarchy or a Manu of a planet delivers his charges to the corresponding official of the new cycle. Then the great pilgrimage of involution and evolution from unity through diversity and back to unity again, this great pilgrimage of involution and evolution is repeated on a higher round of the spiral, and so on and on through all eternity. For the ageless wisdom teaches that this stupendous cyclic evolutionary progression has neither conceivable beginning nor imaginable end. So in the allegory, Noah, personifying the principle of conservation and the great being who carries it out, collects at the command of God his family, that's the human race, and a pair of all animals in the ark. He does this because the period of quiescence is coming on very quickly, and the period of activity is drawing to a close, and all the fruits of it must be preserved. And so those fruits are withdrawn from objective manifestation in form within the great aura, consciousness, or arc of this great official. Then the flood comes, do you see? Meaning that the forms lose their shape and matter goes back to its pre-cosmic, pre-creation condition. And that is always symbolized by waters, flood, the waters of space in fact. Then you will remember when the flood was over and the ark rested on Mount Ararat and was opened, and Noah and his family and the animals came forth, a rainbow shone in the heavens, a covenant, it is said, between God and man. What does that mean? We find it described in the 9th chapter of Genesis, verse 13, more particularly. Well, in one possible interpretation, and please remember that all this is only offered for your consideration, not as final truth, then the covenant, in one interpretation, symbolizes the function of these creative intelligences in bridging the two epochs or cycles of manifestation. For the bow in the heavens is like a bridge, as you find it in other myths and scriptures. The cyclic return after the flood, from simplicity to multiplicity, from the white light to the spectrum, do you see? From the one to the many is indicated by the many colors of the rainbow, a rather beautiful and appropriate symbology. Now let's apply it to our Earth, our planet Earth. It has lived its life. Its period, called a world period, has come to a close. All the fruits of its evolutionary life have been preserved in the arc or aura of a great intelligence, the Manu. The period of quiescence comes on, and it draws to a close, and day, rest, a new dispensation or world period is about to begin. Now let us look at the story from that point of view, our own, the Earth itself, ourselves. Well, applied to the planet Earth, Noah represents the official called the Manu of a single root race, an official in the hierarchy of the adepts, who is responsible for the evolution of a complete race with its 7 sub-races. At a certain phase in that race's evolution, this official receives from his predecessor of the preceding race such of its more advanced and successful members, meaning Noah and his family, as are to be employed as physical progenitors of the next race. This is a general procedure, I may say. The best, shall we say, of a preceding race is preserved by the action of the Manu and generally segregated from the rest of the race and intermarrying and gradually producing a new and higher type under the direction of the Manu. And then civilizations are formed after they emigrate out into the world. And it's these profound teachings which are also referred to allegorically in the account of the flood. However, you know, floods are also quite historical. The deluge recorded in Genesis was a racial historical fact, indeed a series of facts. The secret doctrine teaches that in four great floods, the continent of Atlantis, on which lived the preceding race to the Aryan, millions of the bodies of the inhabitants of Atlantis were drowned in a great flood. Regarded historically, then, the flood of Genesis was the fourth and culminating cataclysm. The souls, spiritual selves, psychical and spiritual, of the people whose bodies were thus destroyed were thereby saved from the deeper degradation into which, as sorcerers and black magicians, in their bodily natures, they might otherwise have descended. For, you know, occult history says that many of the Atlanteans did indeed fall into the errors of sorcery and black magic of a deeply degrading character. Together, these are said to constitute the wickedness referred to as having provoked the wrath of the Lord. You find a reference to this in Genesis 6, verses 5 and 7. So you see, in this historical sense, the story of the flood and of Noah's Ark is a reasonably correct record, except that neither the solar logos, the deity, nor any of the members of the occult hierarchy of adepts on earth, none of these are, of course, capable of wrath. Danger to the evolving souls of men alone necessitated divine intervention. The great war between the law-abiding Atlantean emperor and his forces and the vast armies of the sorcerers is partly referred to in the allegory of the war in heaven. Now let us look at the ark itself, a symbol which is used throughout world scriptures and with a profound meaning. It means an enclosing vehicle or body at whatever level, the enclosing ring-passed knot of a solar system, the aura of a planet, its high authorities, and the aura of man too, his immortal vesture of light, in which between incarnations the fruits of his evolution are all preserved. Then when the next incarnation begins, certain of those fruits are available to the due personality. Do you see how that's reflected in the idea of Noah and his ark? May I go into a little more detail about this with you, drawing upon theosophical teachings? If applied to the seven bodies of man and the successive incarnations of the human ego, as I've just been saying, the ark symbol may be interpreted as the enclosing auric envelope, and more especially the radiance of the soul's vesture of light, called in theosophy the causal body. This vehicle is an ark, or like an ark in truth, for it both contains and preserves between reincarnations the fruits, that means the faculties, the knowledge, the wisdom, the capacity, harvested from each life cycle or incarnation. This vehicle is also an ark in that it serves as a vesture for the threefold spiritual self, the divine will, Noah, the divine wisdom, Noah's family, and the divine intelligence, Noah's wife, which constitute the essential unfolding spiritual soul of man. They were all there, you see. The innermost spiritual will, the head of it all, personified by Noah, the directing being, and then the wisdom, all the family, and then the divine intelligence in man, always represented in occultism, by the by, as feminine, a feminine power represented by Noah's wife. And these constitute, as I've said, the essential, unfolding, spiritual soul of man, for which the causal body is like an ark, a vehicle or vesture of light, during the long period of unfoldment from manhood to superhumanity. Now, the inhabitants of Noah's Ark, human and subhuman, what do they mean? Well, I suggest that they typify all these contents, whilst the three stories in which the Ark is said to have been built refer to the three levels of consciousness I've just referred to: spiritual will, spiritual wisdom, spiritual intelligence. Three stories, do you see, at which the immortal self of man exists. Now, that's rather an abstract idea, difficult for the mind to grasp, and so the ancient teachers put it simply. They called it an ark with three stories. The spiritual self of man, really, with its three powers or aspects, spiritual will, wisdom, and intelligence. Do you see how the process and practice of revelation by allegory is carried out? At the death, then, of each physical body in the succession of lives on earth, the consciousness of the inner self is withdrawn from the physical world through emotional and mental states symbolized by water and air in the story. And these fruits are withdrawn into the vesture of light, or causal body, the ark. And there the inner self with its harvest remains until the opening of the succeeding reincarnation, or in the allegory, dry land reappears. As a symbol, the ark is thus susceptible of many interpretations. In general, it typifies any vehicle of consciousness, whether of cosmos, solar system, sun, planet, human race, or an individual man. In anatomy, the ark is represented by the womb, the wall of the cell, and in physics it is represented by the wall, so-called, of the atom. So you see, the ark, or in Greek arche, is a universal symbol pregnant with wonderful ideas. And we see it used in this story of Noah and his ark. The arks and ships, then, of the allegorical language invented and used by the initiates of the mystery schools of early civilizations, these arks, ships, boats, generally refer to containing vehicles of consciousness of whatever dimensions and at whatever level. And as I've just said, and it's so important, I will repeat it if you'll allow me. These vehicles of consciousness of whatever dimensions and at whatever level include the substance and the ensouling and directing intelligences of the whole universe and its component solar systems, each with its enclosing membrane. This too has an interesting name. It's called the Ringpasna. And in Hinduism, it's called the Rope of Angels. As if God, within and transcendent above his solar system, with the sun at heart, had established a kind of enclosing wall of angels, or ring past not, protecting all that is going to be built within from intrusion from without. The ark symbol and principle, do you see? So also, as I've been saying, the spiritual or causal body of man, the animal and human wombs, the enclosing membrane of a cell, and the wall of an atom. All these are represented by Ark, Arche, the ship. Similarly, the universal principle of the conservation of attributes and developed qualities is exemplified by both the allegory of the flood and the symbol of the ark or boat. Let us now move on to another famous and familiar story in the Bible. I've chosen for our study next the story of the Tower of Babel. We find it chiefly in the 11th chapter of the book of Genesis, and some of the central statements are in verses 7 and 8. But let's look at the literal reading first. The story of the Tower of Babel, and especially of verses 6, 7, 8, and 9 of that 11th chapter of the book of Genesis, also presents a difficulty. For it would seem to imply that the supreme deity became deliberately responsible for the major self-produced sufferings of mankind. For these are caused by self-separateness and excessive individualism. In the text, the Lord is said deliberately to have confounded the language of mankind. According to the text, then, many of the evil and cruel actions performed by man upon man, including individual and organized crime and the waging of innumerable wars, arose and still arise from these two supposed, wrongly supposed, of course, actions of a personal God. What were those actions? Well, first, as in verse 7, to confound human language so that man could no longer understand one another's speech, as the text says. And second, the action was to separate man from man by scattering, quotes, humanity abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, verse 8, close the quotes. Such supposed divine actions, had they really occurred, could indeed be regarded as having been major causes of human errors, born of excessive individualism, as so many of them are. This attribution to the supreme deity pulls one up at once, for of course it's contrary to the whole concept of the godhood. This attribution to God of motive and conduct so detrimental to humanity as to remove for long ages all possibility of harmonious human relationships on earth, this surely is totally unacceptable to the thoughtful and reverent mind. Is there a solution, then, of this problem? Let us try. Let us apply the general principles underlying allegorical writing to the story. Well, as we do so, the story of the Tower of Babel, I think, becomes understandable if interpreted as an account of the evolution of human consciousness out of unified tribal instinct into and later through the inevitable diversity produced by the development of the mind with its attributes of individualism and egoism. It's simply an allegory of the development of the human mind, you see. First of all, there was a certain unity of the very primitive tribes. But this couldn't last. The soul of man evolves his intellect grew and came into action, he saw differences. Some individualism developed and affected action, so that now you have the different people, the different nations, different motives, and different weaknesses of the mankind now living on earth. And so not so much a direct action of God is described to produce this, but there's a revelation of the perfectly normal processes of the evolution of man. It's a wonderful revelation from that point of view. Of course, if you wish, as I've suggested elsewhere, a cosmic significance is also discernible. The incarnation of the one divine life into many forms, the expression of the one creative idea through its innumerable objective manifestations in nature, and the material appearance of the one archetype in myriad tribes and types on the physical plane, all these are allegorized by the story of the Tower of Babel and the splitting up of the human race. The action of building the tower may thus be read as symbolizing entry on the pathway of return from matter to spirit, from earth to heaven, from diversity back to unity. This is supported by the clear statement that the tower was never finished. In fact, the story is not yet complete, is it? For the human race still hasn't achieved its return to unity, though many signs are now appearing of our evolution to a recognition of mutual interdependence. And one day the whole race will know its unity, man with man, all members of one spiritual race, which is without divisions of any kind. But this is in the future, isn't it? Though we must work for it. And the first object of the Theosophical Society is designed to hasten its development. But at present, how wonderfully well the situation is described in the fact that the tower was unfinished. May we not assume that the unfinished state of the Tower of Babel indicates a continuing process, as yet incomplete, while the limitless regions of the sky above suggest an infinity of potential attainment by man, as race and as individual. So you see, thus regarded, a profound truth is revealed, for the famous story may be regarded as portraying progression by the one life from primitive unity through diversity back towards unity again on what is called the pathway of return. So you see, the tower can be seen as entirely symbolic, and its description regarded as one of the many flawless jewels of wisdom which are scattered in prodigal abundance throughout the pages of the Bible. The apparent incredibility of the story, which I referred to deliberately at the beginning, the apparent incredibility of the story in its literal reading and its affront to one's concept of the supreme deity may be regarded as hints, advising the student to search for a wisdom revealing under meaning. Such an approach to the Old Testament is supported by the words of the famous Hebrew rabbi Moses Maimonides, Jewish theologian and historian of the Middle Ages. Maimonides wrote these words, and we do well to remember them, particularly when confronted with statements which we really cannot honestly believe, and in some cases know to be untrue. Here is what he wrote. Every time you find in our books, he's a Jew, remember, talking about the Old Testament and the Pentateuch, Every time you find in our books a tale the reality of which seems impossible, a story which is repugnant to both reason and common sense, then be sure that the tale contains a profound allegory veiling a deeply mysterious truth. And the greater the absurdity of the letter, the deeper the wisdom of the spirit. Wonderful utterance. If this view then be adopted, many of the scriptural stories may justly be regarded as containing deep cosmogonical, religious, psychological, and moral teaching. This approach would seem preferable, wouldn't it, to either of two alternatives. One of these would be to ignore difficult passages, turning the mind away from them, as many people do. It's the best they can do, of course. And the other approach is to discard the whole Bible as being of no value as a source of either inspiration or knowledge. Unfortunately, many people find themselves unable to do anything else. They follow this latter course of discarding the whole Bible, largely because of the numerous biblical misstatements of fact. So indeed, there would seem to be a justification for this choice on the grounds that, in their literal reading, many passages of the Bible do constitute hindrances on the pathway to understanding and spiritual awareness. How different, however, if the whole is regarded as a revelation by symbol, by allegory, and by myth, of profound spiritual truth, of laws and processes and principles and powers, too difficult to understand in their abstract significance, rendered comprehensible by their personification and supposed actions as people we can recognize. That then, friends, is the underlying principle of the sacred language of allegory and symbol.